Okay, as I said before the break, we need to sort of finish off this whole world of contract, and it will also be advantageous to you once you have these sort of parallel courses, the civil procedure course, the property course, and the contracts course, because you would have been knee-deep in all this stuff that's in Henningsen about warranties and about disclaimers and about limitations on remedy. But in essence, what we have in Henningsen is the affirmation of a contract, but the attempt to use the contract for defensive purposes. So we have another one of these situations where the manufacturer sells to the dealer, and the dealer sells to, actually to Klaus, I guess it is. What is that his name?
Yeah.
Klaus, nice Scandinavian name here. And Klaus, in turn, gives the car to his wife, and she's the one who's driving along. Something goes wrong with the steering and crashes into the brick wall. And she wants to recover for her injuries from the manufacturer. And again, the manufacturer, instead of saying, oh, we have no privity, contract has nothing to do with this, they say, oh, we did have, in effect, a contract with respect to that vehicle. Now read your contract carefully, says the manufacturer. Notice that it says in this contract, after all, you did sign it saying you've read it and you agree to these terms, just like that I accept, you click on that before you install that piece of software. Right. Oh, sure, I read that. Yeah. Okay. Now, on page 5 here, in the left-hand column, paragraph 7, it is expressly agreed that there are no warranties expressed or implied, except as follows. So in other words, if it appears we've promised anything, if you got the impression we were making a warranty, that we were promising anything, by signing this you agree that we are not. We're not promising you anything, except we say that each part will be free of defects, and the one thing we will do for you, if you've got a problem with one of our parts, you have to return it, transportation charges prepaid, and then we will, at our option, either replace the defective part, no, we'll repair the defective part, or if we're feeling particularly generous, we will give you a brand new part. So the most that Mrs. Henningsen can expect from us as the manufacturer is we'll send a brand new steering column to her hospital bed. That's what we agreed to. And Mr. and Mrs. Henningsen say, in effect, no, we don't. No, that's not it. And what the court winds up doing, as you read through the opinion, is to say, in effect, that deal that the manufacturer purports to make binding is, in the technical language that you'll get to in the course of your review of the law of contracts, they would say that this provision is unconscionable. We have that word sort of in the vocabulary. Gee, that's really unconscionable. We say there are certain standards of behavior which a person with a conscience couldn't do. You could only do that, you may be familiar with the literature about children without a conscience. I can't remember the author's name, but about essentially kids who have not bonded with some sort of parental or parent substitute kind of figure, who have essentially no concept of other people and are essentially these sort of sociopaths. and grow up, we would say, without a healthy human being has a conscience and has this innate knowledge of right and wrong. And it's not simply a function of, well, what rules have been laid down, what Skinnerian rewards and punishments have been set up, but according to your conscience, what is it that is right and what is wrong? Now, the idea here of a provision, and it's written into the Uniform Commercial Code, this is not some highfalutin philosophical doctrine, it, or not that alone at least, it is part of the Uniform Commercial Code, and it says a provision is unconscionable if, in effect, the judge couldn't in good conscience enforce it. There are two kinds of unconscionability: procedural and substantive. Procedural unconscionability is essentially that you can't enforce something where the person didn't have a reasonable opportunity to make a choice about it. So when Mr. Henningsen is buying this car, he's worried about whether the blue interior is going to go with, you know, whether to get the tape player, the CD changer, whether to get the alloy wheels. He's not thinking about what to do if the steering wheel breaks and whether his remedy will be limited to a new part or what. And so you could complain about the procedural, the lack of sort of procedural due process. You could say it's unconscionable because to sort of slip that past somebody without their chance of really looking at it. You can also say that it's substantively unconscionable if, even with full disclosure, we've got a videotape of the dealer explaining in painful detail to Mr. Henningsen, you know, we try to sell these cars for as low a price as we can. You know, these tort lawyers have made everything so expensive. We can sell you this car for $2,000, but we can give you a $200 discount if you sign this part that says, I agree, I'll take full responsibility for the safety of the car. And we've got on videotape Mr. Henningsen talking about this. Yes, I think it would be better if people made their own choices and blah, 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 blah. And Mr. Henningsen, fully aware of what he's doing, signs that. We might still say, sorry, that deal is unenforceable. We cannot in good conscience permit that. That's substantively unconscionable, just as it is unconscionable to allow you to borrow money at 50% interest. If someone says, I loaned this guy some money and he agreed to pay me 50% interest, we would say, no, that's unconscionable. That's usurious. That exceeds the rate of interest which we think we can lawfully enforce. Regardless of how consensual the relationship was. So, again, here we have this sort of conflict between, on the one hand, is everything just about deals and making sure that people, in fact, made this deal, that they were sober and so forth. When they made the deal, they really knew what they were getting into. You could have people, you know, borrowing money at 50% interest because there was no other source of paying the rent that month or of doing something else. We still wouldn't enforce it. We still wouldn't allow people to do that sort of thing. And again, there is a point at which society will tolerate choice making, and there's a point at which society will say, no, that's exploitation. I as a judge cannot in good conscience enforce this kind of a deal. So you could say that, in effect, it's substantively unconscionable to allow an automobile manufacturer to sell you a car without accepting a duty to use reasonable care in making the car reasonably safe. Society will not tolerate that. No matter how badly you want that car, and you're willing to pay $200, you're willing to accept this dangerous car to get $200 taken off the purchase price, sorry, we don't allow that. Again, because we're afraid that this would lead to exploitation, and we're also afraid of people driving around on the highways. After all, the people who make automobiles are not only putting the drivers of those automobiles at work, as we saw back in Winterbottom versus Wright, if the wheels come off, it could run over a passerby. So this isn't just a deal between the manufacturer and the purchaser, it's a deal between the manufacturer and society. And again, going back to Cardozo's words, we've put the source of the obligation where it ought to be, in some generalized obligation that flows not from your agreement or lack thereof, it flows from society's expectations of what a reasonable automobile manufacturer would do. So, again, this is sort of the end of the story of contract. Contract started as claiming its preemptive authority in this area, its sole authority, and got booted out, replaced by tort law. In its last whimper here, it says, we want the ability to limit our liability through contract, and even at that, the courts say no. It's torts and nothing but torts, 24/7. What a nightmare that is. In fact, it reminds me of... it was a different book Gilmore wrote. You read this, that excerpt from The Death of Contract at the very beginning. He wrote another book called The Ages of American Law, and he finished. It's a similar sort of grand overview, and he finishes it by saying, "In heaven there will be no law, and the lion will lie down with the lamb. In hell there will be nothing but law, and due process will be strictly enforced." So, yeah, in hell there's nothing but tort law, I would guess. But fortunately we have some other things to occupy us between now and then. Okay, now, as we apply tort law to the law of product manufacturers, we say, okay, now let's, rethink this thing. What does tort law require? And so we start with Escola, and I think I've maybe made at least vague reference to Escola before. Ms. Russell. Yes. And what's the burden of proof on her? What does she have to prove? Okay, and how does she propose to show that the explosion of the Coke bottle in her hand was the result of negligence? Yes. And one of the problems that she would have in a res ipsa theory would be... yeah, lack of exclusive control, or alternatively, that there are no other plausible explanations for this injury. And the defendant says, well, it could have happened in mishandling of this bottle. After the accident, you just got a bunch of shards of glass, which are swept up, and we don't know anything more about this bottle. But the majority of the court says, in effect, okay, we'll allow a res ipsa theory because the negligent act we are hypothesizing, that there was something improper about this bottle or something defective about this bottle. It was either overpressurized or there was some crack in the glass or there's something else that caused this bottle to explode. That would have taken place, if in fact that's what caused the explosion of the bottle, it would have taken place while it was in the defendant's exclusive control. Now, the plaintiff would have to provide evidence of sort of a chain of custody. We got the bottles in a, which she did. You get these bottles in a case, you know, wooden rack, you know, the whole case of pop bottles delivered by the, you know, the driver. They get put into the cooler. She takes one of these out without, you know, using it to swat, you know, rodents or, you know, use it to prop the door open or something. Without any kind of mishandling, it sort of spontaneously exploded. So the court thinks that's enough to get this case to the jury. Now, what's significant about this case is the concurring opinion by Justice Traynor. This is back in 1944. 20 years later, Traynor is involved in the formulation of a new standard for product liability. But way back in 1944, Traynor's thinking about this problem, and he's got an idea. What's his idea? Say that again? Well, he calls it strict liability. Does he use absolute? Oh, yeah. Gee, that's rather... but then he qualifies it. It turns out it's not so absolute after all. What is the liability based on? Okay, so let me see if I understand this. I'm driving down the road, or let's say I discover a good friend of mine fatally injured in a collision of a car with a tree. We find his body, you know, in his mangled wreckage of an automobile that left the highway and hit a tree. And I, on his behalf, or his widow's behalf, or whatever, sue the manufacturer of the car, saying, you're absolutely liable, you're strictly liable for the injuries that he suffered in a car you manufactured. What would Traynor say? Would Traynor say that the manufacturer had to pay in that circumstance? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Okay, but there's actually a qualification that he inserts in that. It's not absolute liability in that sense. What is it that the plaintiff has to prove to recover under product liability? Mr. Cleveland? Yeah, he talks about liability, but for a defect in the product. Before I could recover for my friend's car crash, I'd have to come forward with some evidence that the collision occurred because of a defect in the car. And maybe through some sort of accident investigation, going through the wreckage of the car, the evidence on the roadside, skid marks or something else, I could identify what caused the crash. Was it a tire that blew out? Was it a wheel that came off? Was it a steering mechanism that broke? Did he fall asleep at the wheel? Did he swerve to avoid a deer? You know, what is it that caused this car crash? If I can point to a defect in the car, then, according to Traynor, the manufacturer is liable whether the manufacturer used reasonable care or not. The one thing Traynor is removing is to show that this defect was a result of the lack of reasonable care. But Traynor's still assuming that the plaintiff shows us that the product that caused the injury had a defect in it. Now, in 1944, Traynor's simply, you know, sort of this voice in the wilderness suggesting that the law product liability shouldn't be stuck in the world of negligence, that it ought to adopt a standard of strict liability. And so we get Greenman in 1963. Now he's writing for the majority of the court, no longer a voice in the wilderness. He's one of the leaders, essentially, in a nationwide movement to provide a new rule for product liability. And again, Greenman involves this sort of overlap of breach of warranty, which is a contract theory, the difference between breach of express warranty, implied warranty, the claim against the retailer, the claim against the manufacturer. It's all kind of confusing here. But what's noteworthy about the case is that Trainer, speaking for the majority, says we have a new regime, which eventually becomes Section 402A of the restatement, which says it's strict liability for a defect and it is regardless of reasonable care. If the manufacturer proposes to answer, as remember going back to Escola, in Escola, the issue before the House was, did the Coke bottle explode because of negligence? She offers evidence, res ipsa, inference, that a bottle's explosion by itself suggests negligence, but the manufacturer would be free to come back and persuade the jury, despite the appearance of negligence, in fact, we were not negligent. They could take you on a tour through the bottle manufacturing plant and show you all the steps they take to, you know, to ensure that there are no cracked bottles. They have a, you know, X-ray machine, and it'll kick out any bottle that doesn't have a certain thickness of glass. They also test the pressure on the bottles before they leave. So despite the appearance that this thing had a defect, the defendant could propose to say, we used reasonable care. Section 402A of the restatement says, not interested. If the bottle has a defect, you're liable. The other thing they say is that it applies regardless of privity or lack thereof. So again, it's no longer a question about what was the relationship of the plaintiff to the manufacturer. Did they buy it? Did their relative buy it? Did a friend of theirs buy it? Did they get injured because the purchaser lost control of the manufacturer's product and ran over the plaintiff, passerby? Irrelevant. If the plaintiff's injured by a defect in the manufacturer's product, there's liability. Now, one of the things about this is it also is phrased in terms of sellers of defective products. There's no attempt in this formulation to distinguish people who manufacture products from people who merely sell them. So according to the restatement, if you buy a toaster from Walmart. Walmart's liable if that toaster burns down your house. And one of the things we'll see later on is a sense, no, it's not just the sale. It ought to be the people who manufacture these things that are the ones who are the primary targets of product liability. But notice again the way in which it is the time, I sometimes say that product liability speaks tort law with a contract accent. The country, you know, that they spend this long time in the land of contract and picked up sort of a contract accent. So it's the sale of the product that makes the difference here. And similarly, there's a kind of strict liability, a disinterest in the standard of reasonable care. Now, Treanor, in his concurrence in Escola, and in the majority opinion here, repeats this whole idea about the benefits from this kind of strict liability regime, that the cost of defective products is placed on the manufacturer rather than upon the plaintiff. And it's justified by the fact that the manufacturer benefits, essentially, from the sale of these products, and therefore should bear the risk. Now, I think there is some rethinking of this whole principle that people today are not as sure as they were at this point in history of the wisdom of this kind of transfer of responsibility from the plaintiff to the manufacturer. Again, there's a sort of a political issue here about whether or not the world is a better place because the responsibility has been shifted to the manufacturer. And a lot of people think the manufacturers bear too much responsibility, and it's time that you know, pendulum swung back. And as we'll see later on in the restatement third, as you read through the restatement third, you see a lot of that retrenchment reflected in the standards that they apply. And as I think the notes indicate, the restatement third was bitterly opposed by the Trial Lawyers Association when it came to that. But we'll get to that story later on. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. But again, what you have here is, again, sort of the high watermark of the plaintiff's interests to transfer the responsibility to the manufacturer. If there's a defect in the product, the manufacturer pays, plaintiff doesn't have to prove negligence. In the same way, again, going back to Rylands versus Fletcher, or going back to Sigler versus Kuhlman, the manufacturer takes the risk. The manufacturer gets the benefit of this activity, but the manufacturer takes the risk if the product turns out to be defective. Okay, now, that much, I think, is relatively uncontroversial. Relatively. Where the controversy now comes in defining what do we mean by a defect. And this is the sort of, maybe it's the 80-20 rule, you know. 20% of your time is taken up handling 80% of your problems, and then 80% of your time goes into handling this last 20%. That, in one sense, product liability law is extraordinarily simple. You could do it in 20 minutes. You could say, liability for products is based upon whether a product is defective. You prove the product is defective, the manufacturer pays. In one sense, it is that simple. But of course, the $64 million question is, okay, so tell me what this word defect means. And it turns out that we divide this world into three different types of defects. This part is, again, non-controversial, the division into these three different areas. Restatement third relies upon this typology. There are things called manufacturing defects, which is where the product is not manufactured according to the specifications. There's something different about this particular product compared to the other products made like this one. So most Coke bottles don't explode in your hand through normal handling. Something was different about this bottle. Overfilled, cracked glass, something's going on. These kinds of cases, if it is a manufacturing defect, are subject to true strict liability without regard to negligence. Negligence is not part of the determination of what constitutes a defect. We simply make a comparison of the product to the way it was supposed to be, and if it departs from that, and that's what caused the injury, you pay. It gets worse. The next kind of defect is a design defect. Design defects are where the product is defective because it's not made as well as it should be. That was the problem in Greenman, after all. The design of this product, this ShopSmith, which caused the piece of wood he was working on to fly up and hit him in the head. Some kind of, they had some set screw, the thing that held the wood in place, wasn't sufficiently beefy enough. It was kind of a puny and inadequate. And the notion is that a properly designed ShopSmith would have held the wood in place. Now, when we talk about, it's not that this particular ShopSmith was made worse than the other ShopSmith sold. It's not like Escola. This is a design defect. The question is, what standard do we apply to design defects? This is where it gets really difficult to define what we have in mind. And it actually is something that's covered in the case that we'll do tomorrow. I'm going to postpone doing Phillips until tomorrow because I want to start with that tomorrow. Phillips tries to explain what the relationship is between a negligence theory and a strict liability theory. How it is that product liability sort of incorporates an aspect of negligence while retaining strict liability. But again, the major difference between manufacturing defects and design defects, I'll just fill in the other one here, is a warning defect. A warning defect is where the product doesn't need to be physically any different. It just needs a warning attached to it. So, again, that bottle of baby oil arguably is defective unless it has attached to it a warning about the danger of inhalation or aspiration. We're not saying you should make the baby oil any different, that the bottle should have a childproof cap on it, or that the bottle should, or that the mineral oil should, the chemical composition of the product should be any different. If you're talking about a physical difference, that's a design defect. If you're simply talking about the information that goes with the product, that's a warning defect. But again, what is it that makes it defective? The advantage of manufacturing defects is we know them when we see them. We have a standard, and we compare the product in question to the standard, and it either meets it or it doesn't. Another example of a manufacturing defect, aside from the Escola case, several years ago, Boeing had a claim filed against it where there was a two-engine Boeing plane taking off from Heathrow Airport in England. And one of the engines caught on fire. And the standard procedure, they're made so that